This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents China Rich Girlfriend by Kevin Kwan. Read for you by Lydia Look. London, 8 September 2012, 9 a.m. GMT. A red Ferrari 458 Italia crashed through the window of the Jimmy Choo shoe boutique on Sloane Street sometime between 4 a.m. and 4:30 a.m. last night. No one witnessed the accident. Metropolitan Police reported that two passengers were taken to St. Mary's Paddington, where they are being treated for serious but non-critical injuries. The vehicle owner's name was not released pending further investigation. Sarah Lyer, The London Chronicle. Prologue. Beijing Capital International Airport, September 9th, 2012, 7:45 p.m.
Wait a minute. I'm in first class. Take me to first class. Edison Ching said contemptuously to the flight attendant escorting him to his seat.
This is first class, Mr. Ching.
The man in the crisp navy uniform informed him.
Where are the cabins?
Eddie asked, still confused.
Mr. Ching, I'm afraid British Airways does not have private cabins in first class.
Footnote. Unfortunately for Eddie, only Emirates, Etihad Airways and Singapore Airlines have private cabins aboard their Airbus A380s. Emirates even has two shower spa bathrooms with sumptuous shower stalls for first-class travelers. Mile High Club members, take note.
But if you'd allow me to show you some of the special features of your seat.
No, no, that's fine.
Eddie tossed his ostrich leather briefcase onto the seat like a petulant schoolboy.
Fucky fuck. The sacrifices I have to make for the bank today.
Edison Ching, the pampered prince of private bankers, famous in Hong Kong society pages for his bon vivant lifestyle, his dapper wardrobe, his elegant wife, Fiona, his photogenic children, and his superb lineage. His mother is Alexandra Young of the Singapore Youngs, was unaccustomed to such inconveniences. 5 hours ago, he had been interrupted during a luncheon at the Hong Kong Club, rushed aboard the company jet bound for Beijing, and then hustled onto this flight to London. It had been years since he had suffered the indignity of flying commercial, but Mrs. Bao was on this godforsaken plane, and Mrs. Bao needed to be accommodated.
But where exactly was the lady? Eddie expected to find her seated nearby, but the chief purser informed him that there was no such person by that name in the cabin.
No, no, she's supposed to be here. Can you check the flight manifest or something? Eddie demanded. Minutes later, Eddie found himself being led to row 37, seat E, of the aircraft. Economy class, where a petite woman in a white vicuña turtleneck and grey flannel slacks sat sandwiched between two passengers.
Mrs. Bao? Bao Xiaoyan?
Eddie inquired in Mandarin. The woman looked up and smiled wanly.
Are you Mr. Ching?
Yes. So glad to meet you. But I'm sorry we had to meet like this.
Eddie smiled in relief. He had spent the past 8 years managing the Bao family's offshore accounts. But they were such a secretive lot. He had never met any of them until today. Even though she looked rather tired at the moment, Bao Xiaoyan was much prettier than he had imagined. With alabaster skin, large eyes that slanted upward at the edges, and high cheekbones accentuated by the way she wore her jet-black hair, pulled into a tight, low ponytail. She did not look old enough to have a son in grad school.
Why are you seated here? Was there some mix-up? Eddie asked urgently.
No. I always fly economy class, Mrs. Bao replied.
Eddie couldn't hide his look of surprise. Mrs. Bao's husband, Bao Gaoliang, was one of Beijing's top politicians, and what's more, he had inherited one of China's biggest pharmaceutical firms. The Baos weren't just one of his regular clients. They were his ultra-high net worth clients.
Only my son flies first class.
Bao Xiaoyan explained, catching Eddie's look.
Carlton can eat all the fancy Western food, and being a student under so much pressure, he needs all the rest he can get. But for me, it's not worth it. I don't touch airplane food, and I can never sleep on these long flights anyway.
Eddie had to resist the urge to roll his eyes. Typical mainlanders. They lavished every penny on their little emperor and suffered in silence. Well, look where that got them. 23-year-old Carlton Bao was supposed to be at Cambridge finishing his master's dissertation, but had instead spent the previous evening doing his best Prince Harry impersonation, running up a £38,000 bar tab at half a dozen London night spots, wrecking his brand new Ferrari, destroying public property, and almost getting himself killed. And that wasn't even the worst of it. The worst of it, Eddie had been explicitly instructed not to reveal to Bao Xiaoyan. Eddie faced the conundrum. He urgently needed to go over the plans with Mrs. Bao, but he would sooner endure a colonoscopy than spend the next 11 hours slumming it in coach. God in heaven, what if someone recognized him? A picture of Edison Ching crammed into an economy class seat would go viral within seconds. Yet Eddie grudgingly realized that it would be unseemly for one of his bank's most important clients to remain here in steerage while he was up front, stretched out on a flatbed recliner, sipping 20-year-old cognac. He eyed the spiky-haired youth slouching dangerously close to Mrs. Bao on one side, and the elderly woman clipping her nails into the air sickness bag on her other side, a solution springing to mind. Lowering his voice, Eddie said,
"Mrs. Bao, I would, of course, be happy to join you in this cabin, but as there are some highly confidential matters we need to discuss, would you allow me to arrange a seat for you up front? I'm certain the bank would insist that I upgrade you to first class, at our expense, of course, and we will be able to talk much more privately there."
"Well, I suppose if the bank insists..."
Bao Xiaoyan replied a little hesitantly. After takeoff, when aperitifs had been served and they were both comfortably ensconced in the sumptuous pod-like seats facing each other, Eddie wasted no time updating his client.
"Mrs. Bao, I was in contact with London just before boarding. Your son has been stabilized. The surgery to repair his punctured spleen was completely successful, and now the orthopedic team can take over."
"Oh, thank all the gods,"
Bao Xiaoyan sighed, easing back in her seat for the first time. "We've already lined up the top reconstructive plastic surgeon in London, Dr. Peter Ashley, and he will be in the operating room alongside the orthopedic team attending to your son."
"My poor boy,"
Bao Xiaoyan said, her eyes getting moist. "Your son was very lucky."
"And the British girl?"
"The girl is still in surgery, but I'm sure she will pull through just fine," Eddie said, putting on his peppiest smile. Barely 30 minutes earlier, Eddie had been on another plane parked in a private hangar at Beijing Capital International Airport, taking in the grim details during a hastily arranged crisis management meeting with Mr. Tin, the gray-haired head of security for the Bao family, and Nigel Tomlinson, his bank's Asia chief. The two men had climbed aboard the Learjet as soon as it landed, huddling over Nigel's laptop while an associate in London gave the latest update via secure feed video conference.
"Carlton is out of surgery now. He was quite a bit banged up, but being in the driver's seat with his airbag and everything, he actually suffered the least injuries. But with the English girl, it's touch and go. She's still in a coma, and they've relieved the swelling in the brain, but that's all they can do for now."
"And the other girl?"
Mr. Tin asked, squinting at the small pixelated pop-up window.
"We're told she died on impact."
Nigel sighed.
"And she was Chinese?" "We believe so, sir."
Eddie shook his head.
What a fucky mess. We need to track down the next of kin immediately before they are contacted by the authorities.
How do you even fit 3 people into a Ferrari? Nigel asked.
Mr. Tin twirled his phone nervously on the lacquered walnut console. Carlton Bao's father is on a state visit to Canada with the Premier of China, and nothing must interrupt him. My orders from Mrs. Bao are that no hint of any scandal must ever reach his ears. He must never know about the dead girl. Do you understand? There is too much at stake, given his political position. And it is an especially sensitive time, with the big once-in-a-decade changeover in party leadership happening right now.
Of course,
Nigel assured him.
We will say that the white girl was his girlfriend.
As far as the father's concerned, there was only one girl in the car.
Why does Mr. Bao even need to know about the white girl?
Don't worry, Mr. Tin. I have handled much worse dealing with some of those sheikh's children, Eddie boasted. Nigel shot Eddie a warning glare. The bank prided itself on the utmost discretion, and here was his associate blabbing away about other clients.
We have a tactical response team in place in London that I am personally directing, and I can assure you we will do everything to contain this, Nigel said before turning to Eddie. How much do you think it will take to keep Fleet Street quiet?
Eddie inhaled deeply, trying to do some quick calculations.
It's not just the press, the policemen, the ambulance drivers, the hospital staff, the families. There's going to be an assload of people to shut up. I would suggest £10 million for starters.
Well, the minute you land in London, you need to take Mrs. Bao straight to the office.
We need her to sign off on the withdrawal before you take her to the hospital to see her son.
I'm just wondering what we should say if Mr. Bao asks us why we need it so much.
Nigel pondered.
Just say the girl needed some new organs, Mr. Tin suggested.
We can also say we needed to pay the boutique, Eddie added. Those Jimmy Choo's are bloody pricey, you know.
2 Hyde Park, London, September 10th, 2012. Eleanor Young sipped on her morning tea, crafting her little white lie. She was holidaying in London with 3 of her closest friends, Lorena Lim, Nadine Shaw, and Daisy Fu. And after 2 days of being with the ladies nonstop, she desperately needed a few hours on her own. The trip was a much-needed distraction for all of them. Lorena was recovering from a Botox allergy scare. Daisy had gotten into yet another fight with her daughter-in-law over the choice of kindergartens for her grandchildren, and Eleanor herself was depressed that her son, Nicky, had not spoken to her for more than 2 years. And Nadine? Well, Nadine was appalled by the state of her daughter's brand-new apartment.
Alamak! $50 million, and I can't even flush the toilet! Nadine screeched as she entered the breakfast room.
What do you expect when everything is so bloody high-tech? Lorena laughed.
Did the toilet at least help you sway carton?
Footnote. Hokkien for wash your bottom.
No la, I waved and waved at all the stupid sensors, but nothing happened.
Feeling defeated, Nadine plopped down into an ultra-modern chair that appeared to be constructed out of a tangled pile of red velvet ropes.
I don't want to criticize, but I think this apartment of your daughter's is not only hideously modern, it's hideously overpriced.
Daisy commented between bites of toast topped with pork floss.
Aya, she's paying for the name and the location, nothing more.
Eleanor sniffed.
Personally, I would have chosen a unit with a nice view of Hyde Park, rather than the view facing Harvey Nichols. You know my Francesca la. She could care less about the park. She wants to fall asleep staring at her favorite department store. Thank God she finally married someone who can pay her overdraft.
Nadine sighed. The ladies kept quiet. Things hadn't been easy for Nadine ever since her father-in-law, Sir Ronald Shaw, woke up from a 6-year coma and turned off the money spigot on his family's free spending. Her profligate daughter, Francesca, once voted one of the 50 best-dressed women by Singapore Tattle, did not respond well to being put on a clothing budget and decided that her best solution was to embark on a brazen affair with Roderick Liang of the Liang Finance Group Liangs, who had only just married Lauren Lee. Singapore's social set was scandalized, and Lauren's grandmother, the formidable Mrs. Lee Yong Chen, retaliated by making sure every old god family in Southeast Asia shut their doors firmly on the Shaws and the Liangs. In the end, a severely chastened Roderick chose to crawl back to his wife rather than run off with Francesca. Finding herself a social pariah, Francesca fled to England and quickly landed on her feet by marrying some Iranian Jew with $500 million. Footnote. According to Cassandra Shang, a.k.a. Radio 1 Asia. Since moving into Two Hyde Park, the obscenely expensive luxury condominium backed by the Qatari royal family, she was finally on speaking terms with her mother again. Naturally, this gave the ladies an excuse to visit the newlyweds, but of course, they just wanted to check out the much-publicized apartment and, more important, have a free place to stay. Footnote. Women of Eleanor's background would rather camp out 6 to a room or sleep on the floor of anyone they remotely know than spend money on hotels. These are the same women who wouldn't blink at shelling out $90,000 on a South Sea pearl trinket while on holiday. As the women discussed the day's shopping agenda, Eleanor launched into her white lie. I can't go shopping this morning. I'm meeting those boring shangs for breakfast. I need to see them at least once while I'm here, or else they'll be terribly insulted. You shouldn't have told them you were coming, Daisy chided. Alamak, you know that Cassandra Shang will find out sooner or later. It's like she has some special radar. And if she knew I was in England and didn't pay my respects to her parents, I would never hear the end of it. What to do la? Huh? This is the curse of being married to the Youngs, Eleanor said, pretending to bemoan her situation. In reality, even though she had been married to Philip Young for more than 3 decades, his cousins, the Imperial Shangs, as they were known to all, had never extended her any courtesies. If Philip had come with her, they would surely have been invited to the Shang's palatial estate in Surrey, or at the very least to dinner in town. But whenever Eleanor came to England on her own, the Shangs remained as silent as tombs. Of course, Eleanor had long since given up trying to fit in with her husband's snobbish insular clan, but lying about the Shangs was the only way to stop her girlfriends from prying too much. If she was seeing anyone else, her kepo friends, footnote, Hokkien for nosy or meddlesome, might surely want to tag along, but the mere mention of the Shangs intimidated them from asking too many questions. While the ladies decided to spend the morning sampling all the free gourmet delicacies at Harrod's famed food halls, Eleanor, discreetly dressed in a chic camel-colored Acris pantsuit, racing green Max Mara swing coat, and her signature gold-rimmed Cutler & Gross sunglasses. Footnote. Eleanor, who normally didn't wear pricey designer clothes and made a point of bragging that she started getting brand-name fatigue back in the 70s, kept a few choice pieces reserved specifically for special occasions like today. Left the swanky building on Knightsbridge and walked 2 blocks east to the Berkeley Hotel, where a silver Jaguar XJL parked in front of a row of perfectly round topiaries awaited her. Still paranoid that her friends might have followed her, Eleanor glanced around quickly before getting into the sedan and being whisked off. At Connaught Street in Mayfair, Eleanor emerged in front of a smart row of townhouses. Nothing about the red and white brick Georgian facade or the glossy black door hinted at what awaited beyond. She pressed the intercom button, and a voice responded almost immediately. May I help you?
It's Eleanor Young. I have a 10 o'clock appointment, she said in an accent that was suddenly much more British.
Even before she had finished speaking, several bolts clicked open, and an intimidating, thick-set man in a pinstripe suit opened the door. Eleanor entered a bright, stark antechamber, where an attractive young woman sat behind a cobalt blue Maison Janson desk. The woman smiled sweetly and said, "Good morning, Mrs. Young. It won't be a minute. We're just calling up." Eleanor nodded. She knew the procedure well. The entire back wall of the antechamber consisted of steel-framed glass doors leading into a private garden courtyard, and she could already see a bald man in a black suit crossing the garden toward her. The pinstripe-suited doorman ushered her toward the bald man, saying simply, "Mrs. Young for Mr. Diabo." Eleanor noticed that both of them sported barely visible earpieces. The bald fellow escorted her along the glass-canopied walkway that bisected the courtyard, past some neatly trimmed shrubbery, and into the adjoining building. This one, an ultra-modern bunker clad in black titanium and tinted glass.
"Mrs. Young for Mr. Diabo,"
the man repeated into his earpiece, and another set of security locks clicked open smoothly. After a short ride in the elevator, Eleanor felt a sense of relief for the first time that morning as she at last stepped into the richly appointed reception room of the Lechtenberg Group, one of the world's most exclusive private banks. Like many high-net-worth Asians, Eleanor maintained accounts with many different financial institutions. Her parents, who had lost much of their first fortune when they were forced into the Endow concentration camp during the Japanese occupation of Singapore in World War II, had instilled in their children a key mantra: "Never put all of your eggs in one basket." Eleanor remembered the lesson over the next few decades as she amassed her own fortune. It didn't matter that her hometown of Singapore had become one of the world's most secure financial hubs. Eleanor, like many of her friends, still kept money distributed among various banks around the globe in safe havens that would prefer to remain unnamed. The Lichtenberg Group account, however, was the jewel in her crown. They managed the biggest chunk of her assets, and Peter Diabo, her private banker, consistently provided her with the highest rate of return. At least once a year, Eleanor would find some excuse to come to London, where she relished her portfolio reviews with Peter. It did not hurt that he resembled her favorite actor, Richard Chamberlain, around the time he was in The Thornbirds. And on many an occasion, Eleanor would sit across Peter's highly polished Makassar ebony desk and imagine him in a priest's collar while he explained what ingenious new scheme he had put her money in. Eleanor checked her lipstick one last time in the tiny mirror of her Jim Thompson silk lipstick case as she waited in the reception lounge. She admired the huge glass vase filled with purple calla lilies, their bright green stems twisted into a tight spiral formation, and thought about how many British pounds to withdraw from her account on this trip. The Singapore dollar was on a weakening trend this week, so it would be better to spend more in pounds at the moment. Daisy had paid for lunch yesterday, and Lorena covered dinner, so it was her turn to treat today. The three of them had made a pact to take turns paying for everything on this trip, knowing how tight things were for poor Nadine. The silver-edged double doors began to open, and Eleanor rose in anticipation. Instead of Peter Diabo, however, a Chinese lady came walking out, accompanied by Eddie Cheng. "My goodness, Auntie L., what are you doing here?" Eddie blurted out before he could stop himself. Eleanor knew, of course, that her husband's nephew worked for the Lichtenberg Group, but Eddie was head of the Hong Kong office, and never would she imagine running into him here. She had specifically opened her account at the London office so that she would never run the risk of bumping into anyone she might know. Turning scarlet in the face, she stammered, Oh, hi. I'm just meeting a friend for breakfast.
Ayo, I've been caught.
Ah, yes, breakfast, Eddie replied, realizing the awkwardness of the situation. Well, of course the crafty bitch would have an account with us.
I got here 2 days ago. I'm here with Nadine Shaw, you know, visiting Francesca. Now the whole damn family will know I have money stashed away in England.
Ah, yes, Francesca Shaw. Didn't I hear she married some Arab? Eddie asked politely.
Amma is always worried Uncle Philip doesn't have enough to live on. Wait till she hears this.
He's an Iranian Jew, very handsome. They just moved into a flat at 2 Hyde Park,
Eleanor replied.
Thank goodness he can never know my 16-digit account number.
Wah! He must do very well, Eddie said in mock awe. My God, I'm going to have to grill Peter Diabo about her account. Not that he'll tell me anything. That stuffed shirt.
I would imagine he does very well. He's a banker just like you,
Eleanor retorted. She noticed that the Chinese woman looked rather anxious to leave and wondered who she might be. For a mainlander, she was dressed in an elegant, understated manner. Must be one of his bigwig clients. Of course, Eddie was doing the proper thing by not introducing her.
What were the both of them doing in London?
Well, I hope you enjoy your breakfast, Eddie said with a smirk as he took off with the lady. Later that day, after Eddie had taken Bao Xiaoyan to the intensive care unit of St. Mary's Paddington to see Carlton, he brought her to dinner at Mandarin Kitchen on Queensway, thinking the lobster noodles might cheer her up. Footnote.
Never mind that the restaurant inexplicably resembles a 1980s Greek taverna. With its whitewashed barrel vault ceilings, Asian foodies will fly to London just to savor Mandarin Kitchen's signature dish. Because nowhere else in the world can one get Chinese hand-pulled egg noodles braised in an intoxicating ginger scallion sauce served with giant lobsters caught daily from the Scottish Sea.
But apparently, women lost their appetites when they couldn't stop crying. Xiaoyan had been utterly unprepared for the sight of her son. His head had swollen to the size of a watermelon, and there were tubes sticking out everywhere, from his nose, his mouth, his neck. Both of his legs were broken. There were second-degree burns on his arms, and the part that remained unbandaged looked as if it had been completely smashed in, like a plastic bottle that had been stepped on. She wanted to stay with him, but the doctors wouldn't let her. Visiting hours were over. No one told her it had been this bad. Why didn't someone tell her? Why didn't Mr. Tin? And where was her husband? She was furious with him. She was mad that she had to face this all alone, while he was cutting off ribbons and shaking hands with Canadians. Eddie squirmed awkwardly in his seat as Xiaoyan sobbed uncontrollably in front of him. Why couldn't she just get a grip? Carlton had survived. A few rounds of plastic surgery and he would be as good as new. Maybe even better. With Peter Ashley, the Michelangelo of Harley Street, working his magic, her son would probably turn out looking like the Chinese Ryan Gosling. Before arriving in London, Eddie assumed that he could clean up this mess in a day or two and still have time to get fitted for a new spring suit at Joe Morgan's, and maybe a couple new pairs of Cleverleys. But big cracks were beginning to show in the dam. Someone had tipped off the Asian press, and they were sniffing around furiously. He needed to meet with his inside man at Scotland Yard. He needed to get to his Fleet Street contacts. Things were in danger of bursting wide open, and he did not have time for hysterical mothers. Just when things couldn't get any worse, Eddie saw a familiar flash out of the corner of his eye. It was damn Auntie Elegant entering the restaurant with Mrs. Q.T. Fu, that woman, what's her name, from the Lorient jewelry family, and that tacky Nadine Shaw.
Fucky fuck. Why must all the Chinese visiting London dine at the same three restaurants? Footnote. The Holy Trinity are Four Seasons for the roast duck, Mandarin Kitchen for the aforementioned lobster noodles, and Royal China for the dim sum.
Just what he needed. Asia's biggest gossip queens witnessing Bao Xiaoyan having a meltdown.
But wait, maybe this wasn't necessarily a bad thing. After this morning at the bank, Eddie knew he had Eleanor by her proverbial balls. He could get her to do almost anything. And right now,
He needed someone he could really trust to handle Bao Shaoyan while he handled the cleanup. If the lady was seen having a marvelous dinner in London with Asia's leading socialites, it could actually work to her advantage and get the ravenous reporters off their trail. Eddie got up and strutted over to the round table in the middle of the dining room. Eleanor was the first to see him approaching, and her jaw tightened in annoyance.
Of course Eddie Ching would come here. The idiot better not say anything about seeing me this morning, or I will sue Lichtenberg Group till kingdom come.
Auntie El, is that you?
Oh my goodness, Eddie! What are you doing in London?
Eleanor gasped, giving a look of utter surprise. Eddie grinned broadly, leaning over to give her a peck on the cheek. My God, somebody hand her the Oscar now. I'm here on business. What a lovely surprise to see you here. Of all places.
Eleanor breathed a sigh of relief.
Thank God he's playing along.
Ladies,
you all know my nephew from Hong Kong? His mother is Philip's sister, Alex, and his father is the world-famous heart surgeon, Malcolm Ching.
Of course, such a small world, la.
The women chirped excitedly.
How is your dear mother these days?
Nadine asked eagerly, even though she had never in her life met Alexandra Ching.
Very well, very well. Mum is in Bangkok at the moment visiting Auntie Kat.
Yes, yes, your Thai auntie,
Nadine answered in a slightly awed tone, knowing that Catherine Young had married into Thai aristocracy. Eleanor had to resist the temptation to roll her eyes. That Eddie didn't waste any opportunity to do some name-dropping. Switching to Mandarin, Eddie said, May I introduce all you lovely ladies to Mrs. Bao Shaoyan? The women nodded politely at the newcomer. Nadine noted immediately that she was wearing a Lauro Piana cashmere cardigan, a beautifully cut pencil skirt from Celine, sensible low-heel pumps from Robert Clairgeret, and a pretty patent leather handbag of indistinguishable brand.
Verdict.
Boring, but unexpectedly classy for a mainlander. Lorena zeroed in on her diamond ring. That rock was between 8 and 8.5 carats. D color, VVS1 or VVS2 grade, radiant cut, flanked by two triangular yellow diamonds of 3 carats apiece, set in platinum. Only Ronald Abram in Hong Kong had that particular setting.
Verdict.
Not too vulgar, but she could have gotten a better stone if she bought from L'Orient.
Daisy, who didn't care one bit about how someone looked and was rather more interested in bloodlines, asked in Mandarin.
Bao. Might you be related to the Baos of Nanjing?
Yes, my husband is Bao Gaoliang,
Mrs. Bao said with a smile.
At last, someone who speaks proper Mandarin. Someone who knows who we are.
Aiya, what a small world! I met your husband the last time he was in Singapore with the Chinese delegation. Ladies, Bao Gaoliang is the former governor of Jiangsu province. Come, come. You should both join us.
We were just about to order dinner,
Daisy graciously offered. Eddie beamed.
You're much too kind. Actually, we could use some company. You see, it's been quite a distressing time for Mrs. Bao. Her son was injured in a car accident 2 days ago in London.
Oh, my goodness!
Nadine cried. Eddie continued. I'm afraid I can't stay, as I have to take care of some pressing matters for the Bao family. But I am quite sure Mrs. Bao would enjoy your company. She doesn't know London well, so she's at quite a loss here.
Don't worry, we'll take good care of her,
Lorena offered charitably. I'm so relieved. Now, Auntie El, can you point me to the best spot to catch a taxi?
Of course,
Eleanor said, walking her nephew out of the restaurant. While the ladies consoled Bao Shaoyan, Eddie stood outside the restaurant giving Eleanor the lowdown. I know this is a big favor I'm asking of you. Can I count on you to keep Mrs. Bao occupied and entertained for a while? More important,
Can I count on your absolute discretion? We need to ensure that your friends do not ever discuss Mrs. Bao with the press, especially the Asian press. I will be in your debt.
Aya, you can trust us. 100%.
My friends would never gossip or anything,
Eleanor insisted. Eddie nodded solicitously, knowing full well that all the ladies would be texting the news back to Asia at warp speed the minute he was gone. Those pesky gossip columnists would be sure to mention it in their daily reports, and everyone would think Xiaoyan was just in London to shop and eat.
Now, can I count on your discretion?
Eleanor asked, looking him straight in the eye. I'm not sure I know what you're talking about, Auntie Elle, Eddie said with a smirk.
I'm talking about my breakfast this morning.
Oh, don't worry. I already forgot about that. I took an oath of secrecy when I joined the world of private banking, and I wouldn't dream of ever betraying it. At the Lichtenberg Group, what can we offer but discretion and trust? Eleanor returned to the restaurant, feeling rather relieved by the strange turn of events. She was getting to even the score with her nephew. A huge platter, upon which lay the most enormous lobster over a bed of steaming hot noodles, sat in the middle of the table, but no one was eating. The ladies all looked up at Eleanor with rather peculiar expressions on their faces. She figured they must be dying to know what Eddie had told her outside. Daisy smiled brightly as Eleanor sat down and said,
Mrs. Bao was just showing us some pictures of her handsome son on her phone. She is so worried about his face. And I was just assuring her that the plastic surgeons in London are some of the best in the world.
Daisy handed over the phone, and Eleanor's eyes widened almost imperceptibly as she locked onto the image.
Don't you think he's handsome?
Daisy asked in an almost too cheery tone. Eleanor looked up from the phone and said ever so nonchalantly, Oh, yes, very handsome. None of the other ladies said anything else about Mrs. Bao's son for the rest of the dinner, but all of them were thinking the same thing. There was no way it could be a coincidence. Bao Xiaoyan's injured son looked just like the woman who had caused the great estrangement between Eleanor and her son, Nicholas. Yes, Carlton Bao was the spitting image of Rachel Chu. Part 1. Everyone claims to be a billionaire these days, but you're not really a billionaire until you spend your billions. Overheard at the Hong Kong Jockey Club. Chapter 1. The Mandarin. Hong Kong, January 25th, 2013. In early 2012, a brother and sister clearing out their late mother's attic in the London neighborhood of Hampstead discovered what appeared to be a cluster of old Chinese scrolls at the bottom of a steamer trunk. By chance, the sister had a friend who worked at Christie's, so she dropped them off in four Sainsbury's grocery sacks at the auctioneer's sales room on Old Brompton Road, hoping they might take a look and tell us if they're worth anything. When the senior specialist of Chinese classical paintings opened up one of the silk scrolls, he nearly went into cardiac arrest. Unfurled before him was an image so remarkably rendered, it immediately reminded him of a set of hanging scroll paintings long thought to be destroyed. Could this be the Palace of 18 Perfections? The artwork, created by the Qing Dynasty artist Yuan Jiang in 1693, was believed to have been secretly removed from China during the Second Opium War in 1860, when many of the royal palaces were ransacked and lost forever. As staffers scurried around unrolling the scrolls, they discovered 24 pieces, each almost 7 feet tall and in immaculate condition. Placed side by side, they spanned 37 feet, almost filling the floor space of two workrooms. At last,
The senior specialist could confirm that this was undoubtedly the mythical work described in all the classical Chinese texts he had spent much of his career studying. The Palace of 18 Perfections was an opulent 8th century imperial retreat in the mountains north of modern-day Xi'an. It was said to be one of the most magnificent royal residences ever built, with grounds so vast that one had to travel between the halls on horseback. On these ancient silk scrolls, the intricate pavilions, courtyards, and gardens that meandered through a dreamlike blue and green mountain landscape were painted in colors so vibrantly preserved, they seemed almost electric in their iridescence. The auction house staff stood over the exquisite masterpiece in awed silence. A find of this caliber was like discovering a long, hidden painting by Da Vinci or Vermeer. When the international director of Asian art rushed in to see them, he began to feel faint and forced himself to take a few steps back for fear that he might fall onto the delicate artwork. Choking back his tears, the director finally said,
"Call Francois in Hong Kong. Tell him to get Oliver Sen on the next flight to London."
Footnote: Oliver Sen, one of Christie's most highly valued deputy chairmen, has long-standing relationships with many of the world's top collectors, being related to practically every important family in Asia didn't hurt. The director then declared, "We need to give these beauties the grand tour. We're going to start out with an exhibition in Geneva, then London, then at our Rockefeller Center showroom in New York. Let's give the world's top collectors a chance to see it. Only then will we take it to Hong Kong and sell it right before the Chinese New Year. By then, the Chinese should be frothing at the mouth in anticipation." Which is precisely how Corinna Kotung came to be sitting in the Clipper Lounge of the Mandarin Hotel in Hong Kong a year later, impatiently awaiting the arrival of Lester and Valerie Liu. Her richly embossed business card listed her as an art consultant, but for a few select clients, she was a great deal more than that. Corinna was born to one of Hong Kong's most pedigreed families, and she secretly parlayed her extensive connections into a very profitable sideline. For clients like the Liu's, Corinna did everything from refining the art on their walls to the clothes on their back, all in service of getting them memberships at the most elite clubs, their names onto the right invitation lists, and their children into the city's top schools. In short, she was a special consultant for social climbers. Corinna spotted the Liu's as they ascended the short flight of stairs up to the mezzanine lounge overlooking the lobby. The couple cut quite a striking picture, and she had to pat herself on the back for this. The first time Corinna met the Liu's, they were both in head-to-toe Prada. To the new arrivals from Guangdong, it was the height of sophistication, but to Corinna, it just screamed clueless mainland money. Thanks to her handiwork, Lester entered the Clipper Lounge looking particularly dapper in a bespoke three-piece suit from Kilgore of Savile Row, and Valerie was chicly clad in a silvery Persian lamb parka from J. Mondel, appropriately sized black pearls and dove-gray suede Longvon ankle boots. But there was something a little off about her outfit. The handbag was a mistake. The glossy, ombre-dyed reptile skin bag obviously came from some nearly extinct species, but it reminded Corinna of the sort of handbag only a mistress would carry. She made a mental note to drop a hint at the appropriate moment. Valerie arrived at the table apologizing profusely. "I'm sorry we're late. Our chauffeur mistakenly took us to the landmark Mandarin Oriental instead of this one." "Not a problem," Corinna replied graciously. Tardiness was one of her pet peeves, but with the kind of retainer the Liu's were paying her, she wasn't about to complain. "I'm surprised you wanted to meet here. Don't you think the tea room at the Four Seasons is much nicer?" Valerie asked.
"Or even the Peninsula," Lester chimed in, casting a dismissive eye at the rectangular 1970s-era chandeliers cascading from the ceiling of the lobby.
"The Peninsula gets too many tourists,"
And the Four Seasons is where all the new people go. The Mandarin is where proper Hong Kong families have been coming to tea for generations. My grandmother, Lady Ko Tung, used to bring me here at least once a month when I was a girl. Corinna patiently explained, adding, "You must also leave out the Oriental. We locals simply call it the Mandarin."
"Oh,"
Valerie replied, feeling a little chastised. She glanced around, taking in the subdued oak-paneled walls and armchairs with just the perfect amount of sag in the seat cushions, her eyes suddenly widening. Leaning closer in, she whispered excitedly to Corinna,
"Do you see who's over there? Isn't that Fiona Tung Ching with her mother-in-law, Alexandra Ching, having tea with the Ladouris?"
"Who are they?" Lester asked, a little too loudly.
Valerie nervously shushed her husband in Mandarin. "Don't stare. I'll tell you later."
Corinna smiled in approval. That Valerie was a quick study. The Liu's were relatively new clients, but they were Corinna's favorite type of clients. Red royals, she called them. Unlike fresh-off-the-boat mainlander millionaires, these heirs of China's ruling class, known in China as Fu Er Dai, or second-generation rich, had good manners and good teeth and had never known the deprivation of their parents' generation. The tragedies of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution were ancient history as far as they were concerned. Obscene gobs of money had come easily to them, so obscene gobs they were ready to part with. Lester's family controlled one of China's largest insurance companies, and he met Valerie, the Shanghai-born daughter of an anesthesiologist, when they were both at the University of Sydney. With an ever-growing fortune and ever-refining taste, this 30-something couple was ambitiously striving to make their mark on the power scene in Asia. With homes in London, Shanghai, Sydney, and New York, and a newly constructed house that resembled a cruise liner in Hong Kong's deep water bay, they were anxiously filling the walls with museum-quality art in the hopes that Hong Kong Tattle might soon do a feature. Lester got right down to business. "So how much do you think these scrolls will end up going for?"
"Well, that's what I wanted to discuss with you. I know you said you were prepared to go up to 50 million, but I have a feeling we will break all records tonight."
"Would you be prepared to go up to 75? Corinna said carefully, testing the waters. Lester didn't flinch. He reached for one of the sausage puffs on the silver cake stand and said, "Are you sure it's worth that much?"
"Mr. Liu, this is the single most important work of Chinese art to ever come on the market. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity." "It's going to look so good in the rotunda," Valerie couldn't help blurting out. "We're going to hang it so that the whole painting is panoramic, and I'm having the walls on the first and second floors repainted to exactly match the colors. I love those turquoise tones."
Corinna ignored Valerie's chatter and continued, "Aside from the artwork itself, the value of owning it will be incalculable. Think how much it will raise your profile, your family's profile, once it's known that you acquired it. You will have beat out the top collectors in the world. I'm told that representatives for the Bins, the Wangs, and the Kwoks are bidding. And the Huangs just flew in from Taipei. Interesting timing, isn't it? I also have it on good authority that Colin and Araminta Koo sent a special team of curators from the National Palace Museum in Taipei to examine the piece last week."
"Oh, Araminta Koo. She's so beautiful and chic. I couldn't stop reading about that incredible wedding of hers. Do you know her?"
Valerie asked.
"I was at the wedding," Corinna said simply.
Valerie shook her head in wonder. She tried to imagine the middle-aged, mousy-looking Corinna, who always wore the same three Giorgio Armani pantsuits at the most glamorous event ever to hit Asia. Some people had all the luck, being born into the right family. Corinna continued her lecture. "So let me give you the drill. The auction tonight begins at 8 sharp, and I have secured us entry to the Christie's VVIP skybox. That is where you will be throughout the auction. I will be downstairs on the auction room floor, bidding exclusively for you.
We won't be with you?
Valerie was confused. No, no. You'll be in this special lounge where you can look down onto all the action.
But won't it be more exciting to be down on the floor itself?
Valerie pressed on. Corinna shook her head. Trust me, you don't want to be seen on the auction floor. The VVIP skybox is where you want to be. That's where all the top collectors will be. And I know you will enjoy that. Wait a minute, Lester interrupted. What's the point of buying the damn thing then? How will anyone know we made the winning bid? First of all, you will be seen by everyone at the VVIP skybox. So people will already suspect, and first thing tomorrow, I will have one of my sources at the South China Morning Post issue an unconfirmed report that Mr. and Mrs. Lester Liu of the Harmony Insurance family acquired the painting. Trust me, that's the classy way to do it. You want people to speculate. You want to be that unconfirmed report.
Oh, you're so brilliant, Corinna!
Valerie squealed in excitement. But if it's unconfirmed, how will people know? Lester was still confused.
Hiya, slow tortoise. Everyone will see the painting when we throw our housewarming party next month.
Valerie chastised her husband, smacking him on the knee.
They will confirm it with their own envious eyes.
The Hong Kong Convention and Exhibition Center, situated right on the harbor in Wan Chai, boasted overlapping curved roofs that resembled a gigantic manta ray gliding through the water. That same evening, a parade of starlets, bold-faced named socialites, low-level billionaires, and the sort of people Corinna Ko Tung deemed to be inconsequential paraded through the Grand Hall, vying for the most visible seats at the auction of the century, while the back of the room was packed to the rafters with the international press and onlookers. Upstairs in the plush VVIP skybox, Valerie and Lester were in seventh heaven as they rubbed elbows with the serious money crowd over Laurent Perrier champagne and canapés prepared by Café Grey. When at last the auctioneer stepped up to the polished wood podium, the lights in the hall began to dim. A massive gold latticework screen ran along the wall facing the stage, and at the appointed moment, the screen began to part, revealing the hanging scrolls in all their glory. Brilliantly enhanced by the state-of-the-art lighting system, they almost appeared to glow from within. The crowd gasped. And when the lights came up again, the auctioneer promptly began the session without any fuss.
An exceedingly rare set of 24 hanging scrolls from the Qing Dynasty, ink and color on silk, depicting the Palace of 18 Perfections by Yuan Jiang, inscribed by the artist and dated 1693. Shall we have an opening bid of 1 million?
Valerie could feel the adrenaline coursing through her veins as she saw Corinna raise her blue-numbered paddle to volley the first bid. A flurry of paddles began popping up around the room, and the price began its stratospheric climb. 5 million. 10 million. 12 million. 15 million. 20 million. Within a matter of minutes, the bid was at 40 million. Lester leaned forward in his chair, analyzing the action on the auction room floor like some complex chess match, and Valerie clawed her nails into his shoulder repeatedly in high anticipation. When the bidding hit 60 million, Lester's phone rang. It was Corinna, sounding frantic.
Soi do say?
Cantonese for so rotten I could die.
It's going up too fast. We're going to pass your 75 million limit in no time. Do you want to keep bidding?
Lester breathed in deeply. Any expenditure over 50 million would surely be noticed by his father's bean counters, and there would be some explaining to do.
Keep going till I stop you, he ordered.
Valerie's head was spinning in excitement. They were so close. Imagine, soon she would own something that even Araminta Koo coveted. At 80 million, the bidding finally slowed down. No more paddles in the room were raised with the exception of Corinna's, and it seemed like there were only two or three telephone buyers remaining to bid against the Lews. The price was going up only in increments of 500,000, and Lester closed his eyes, praying he would get it for under 90 million. It was worth it. It was worth the scolding he would get from his father. He would make his plea that he had bought the family $1 billion worth of good publicity. Suddenly, there came a commotion from the back of the auction room. Murmurs could be heard as the standing room-only crowd began to give way. Even in a room packed with celebrities dressed to the nines, a hush came over the space as a strikingly attractive Chinese woman with jet-black hair, powdered white skin, and crimson lips, dramatically dressed in a black velvet off-the-shoulder gown, emerged from the crowd. Flanked by two snow-white Russian wolfhounds on long diamond leashes, the lady began to walk slowly up the central aisle as every head swiveled toward the sensational sight. Clearing his throat discreetly into the mic, the auctioneer tried to regain the attention of the room.
I have 85.5 million. Who will say 86?
One of the associates manning a telephone nodded. Corinna immediately raised her paddle to challenge that bid. And then the lady in black velvet raised her paddle. Looking down from the skybox, the director of Christie's Asia turned to his associates in astonishment and said,
I thought she was just some publicity seeker.
Straining to take a better look, the director observed,
her paddle number is 269. Someone find out who she is. Is she even pre-qualified to bid?
Oliver Sin, who was in the lounge bidding on behalf of a private client, had been staring intently with his opera glasses at the lady with the silken-haired dogs ever since she entered. He let out a chuckle.
Don't worry. She's pre-qualified.
Who is she?
The director demanded.
Well, her nose and chin have been refined, and it looks like she's also gotten cheek implants. But I'm quite certain bidder number 269 is none other than Mrs. Tai.
Carol Tai, the widow of Dato Tai To Liu, that tycoon who died last year.
No, she's the wife of Bernard, the Dato's son who inherited all of his father's billions. That lady in black is the soap opera star formerly known as Kitty Pong.
Wan Chai, Hong Kong, 8:25 p.m. This is special correspondent Sunny Choi reporting for CNN International. I'm live at the Hong Kong Convention and Exhibition Center, where the world's top collectors are in a frenzied state of bidding for the Palace of 18 Perfections. The price has just hit $90 million. To put this into perspective, a Qianlong vase was sold in London for a record-breaking U.S. $85.9 million in 2010. But that's London. In Asia, the highest price ever achieved was U.S. $65.4 million for an ink painting by Qi Baishi in 2011. The authenticity of the painting was later questioned, and the buyer retracted the bid. They probably realized it wouldn't match their sofa. So this painting has already broken two world records. Now about 10 minutes ago, the former actress Kitty Pong, who was married to billionaire Bernard Tai, brought the auction to a standstill when she made an entrance with two gigantic dogs on diamond leashes and began bidding. Right now, there are four others bidding against her. We're told that one is a representative for the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. Another suspected bidder is the heiress Araminta Lee Koo. And there are unconfirmed reports that the third bidder is a representative for the Liu insurance family. We don't know who the fourth mystery bidder is yet. Back to you, Christiane. Upper Gudari,
Republic of Georgia, 12:30 a.m.
There's some ridiculous woman in black with two frigging dogs who will not stop bidding.